Hey, everybody. On this episode of I Talk Movies, we're getting up close and personal with director Scott Mann. Let's do it.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk. We talk movies. And now, here's Popcorn Talk's I Talk Movie.
Hey, everybody. Look at that. Little Frankie Goes to Hollywood plays us into this episode of I Talk Movies. This is the show where you talk to the people both in front and behind the camera that bring you all that great entertainment you get to see at the theater, at home, or on your mobile streaming device. I'm your host, Frank Moran. My guest today is a director who hails from the UK. He's worked with such greats as Jeffrey Dean Morgan, Vince Vaughn, Jeffrey Dean Morgan, and the legendary Robert De Niro. His latest film is Final Score, starring Dave Bautista, Pierce Brosnan, and Ray Stevenson. It comes out in theaters, video on demand, and digital HD on September 14th. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Scott Mann.
Thank you.
Hello.
Hey. I'm sure Vince Vaughn would have been lovely to work with.
You know, but Vince Vaughn, I've heard, he's great chap, right?
Yeah, but Ving Rhames. We got to give
Ving Rhames give credit to Ving Rhames, right?
this is Two Tribes from Frankie Goes to Hollywood. And you were saying that you were stoked when you got a chance to use this for the film.
That's right, yeah. We used this in Final Score, and it was very... it was hard to kind of find something that kind of struck the right tone. And we were doing, it was the top of the movie where we were kind of giving the setting of what the movie, the history of the movie, the backstory and everything happened in it. And it was kind of a period, so it fitted really nicely. And I've always loved the song, so to be able to use it was a delight, yeah.
So for you, when you hear a piece of music like that, and it's a song you enjoy, you just kind of keep it in your mental Rolodex, like, I want to use this at some point in my filmmaking career. And I just have to wait for the right opportunity.
Yeah, all the time. And the truth is, normally you don't get the chance because normally things are too expensive or it's too late. You know, I think post-production in all films, most films that I've been involved with at least, you know, that's where everything gets hit hardest with the budget restraints. Do you know what I mean? So everyone, it's kind of a sad state of affairs that the composer is always the one who gets, who gets the smallest budget and there's no wiggle room because it's been spent on other things. So the score and the music often gets hit with that. But we really pushed to make room to get that song in because not only did it kind of set up the film right and set about this kind of weird tone that we were going for, it also worked kind of nice in one of the action set pieces. And again, it struck the right tone. So, it's one of my faves.
Is it also when it comes to securing a song like that, certainly the money to have the rights for that, but is it the time that it takes to get the approval to use it? Does that also factor in?
Yeah, it's difficult. You know, you have to be careful with these things. I think because I've in the past fallen in love with songs and cut a scene to a song, for example, really wanted to use it. Like there's a song I really wanted to use for the end of Heist for the kind of play out track. And I remember you kind of fall in love with it so much that then either the people who are licensing to you might get a sniff of that and the price goes up and then it becomes an impossibility and then letting go of it is harder. So, I try now to hold off till we know for certain that we've got it and like try and keep myself emotionally away from it. So I was very excited at the possibility of using that track, but until we actually secured it, I kind of held myself off, kind of falling in love too much with it because I didn't know if we'd really get it. So
for that, if you're trying to keep your distance and you're cutting the sequence that you want to use, the action sequence to this music, do you cut it as for that you're going for picture lock or do you kind of just cut it to the general beat and that, you know, if you have to pull it out, it won't be as hard to put another song
in? No, you have to push it. Like, because it's also, I always think like a picture lock is a pitch to everyone involved, including the producers, to say, look, this is the version of the film we're trying to achieve here. And this is obviously the rough version of the film we're trying to achieve. But you kind of need those tracks in there to be able to say, hey guys, I think we should try and make a play for this track because it works really well. Or the tracks are in and around. And it's from that process really that everyone kind of decides, do we want to really make the effort and the financial effort to do this or not, you know? So we normally have it in there. And then if you have to change it, it's tricky, you know? Like we did talk, I'll be honest, we went back and forth on that track for a set piece. We always had it at the start of the film, which was the most important part of it. But when it came to doing there's a motorcycle chase through the middle of the movie, We tried a whole bunch of different tracks and tried various different ones, and we always ended up coming back to it, you know. And in the end, it was literally down to the final day of the final mix, and we would mixing, we basically had two tracks to choose from, which we showed to the producers. I remember saying, look, we've tried these different things, let, you know, see it and decide yourself, because I'm in love with one and not so much in the other, but you decide. And they went with that. So I was very happy that they did.
Oh, that's excellent.
Yeah.
Well, before we talk a little bit more about Final Score, let's just jump back a little bit about you. So from the UK, we'll talk about Scott's favorite subject himself.
Yeah, me. You just talk about me. You go ahead, fire away.
So born and raised in the UK?
Absolutely, yeah. Northeast of England, a place called Newton Aycliff, which is near Darlington in the northeast of England, and all of those places, maybe people have an idea. It's in the UK. It's in on the earth.
It's on the earth.
It's on the earth. I was born on the earth. And yeah, I grew up there and then moved to Manchester when I was a young adult of 17.
And was filmmaking already something that was in your mind when you moved to Manchester?
You know, I actually moved to Manchester with a job working for a television company. So I'd always wanted to make films from as young as I remember. Probably 10 years old is the earliest, I would say, that I can remember. I did like this little kind of short film with my friend Gavin Hope and his dad, because they had a camcorder, and we messed around kind of pretending to shoot each other, and we did the rope thing, you know, like tied a rope around the waist, and I think I got shot, he got shot, timed him with a gunshot, and we slapped a book to make a bang. Very like simple stuff, but I it was from there I managed to get my own camera, I think 12 years old, and I made all these silly short films, and you learn the kind of techniques of what I use today, you know. Mm-hmm. I think a good thing from going from that kind of super low budget, like no budget world really, and having a love for genre material kind of makes you kind of root out the ways, the best ways to kind of pull off certain things. And I was always a big admirer of, say, Robert Rodriguez, what he did with his first few movies. And I think that's kind of been a good kind of thing for, it was kind of a good education through it, because you do learn how, like with Final Score, but the amount of kind of low-tech tricks that you can incorporate into this high-tech kind of world, you can kind of pull off some pretty cool stuff that's all rooted in pretending to shoot each other in a garden age 10, you know.
What was the first TV show or film that made you realize, like, oh, wait, this is something I could do?
Yeah, I'd say probably Terminator 2 and RoboCop are two movies that are hugely kind of ingrained in me from childhood. And I remember being kind of shocked by RoboCop, because I think I watched RoboCop age 11 or 12. Like, I really shouldn't have watched it. But I remember looking away when he gets his arm blown off. But apart from that, it was, you know. But I think, yeah, those two movies especially. Like, I watched those movies religiously. And I remember we have like a 6-week holiday period in England. I remember every single day I would watch Terminator 2 before my parents woke up, and I would look at like every shot and see how things are structured and see how set pieces are made from a filmmaking point of view. And I think, and it's a great way to learn how to make movies. Like, look at the very best ones, look at kind of how they're made up, and it's a little bit cart before the horse, because you're kind of looking at the end product without understanding what goes into it. But yeah, it's a great way to learn, and that's probably what kicked me off, yeah.
Is it challenging, though, with the James Cameron film, especially Terminator 2, where he made so many advances in what you could do with special effects, to watch that and go, oh, that's something I could easily replicate now?
Well, funnily enough, when I was a kid, I love that merging of technologies, I do. I think the great thing, I start off like doing animation, like very basic animation on my Amiga 500 computer, and Deluxe Paint 3, I believe, was my go-to animation package choice. And that was my first ever kind of like, you know, moving picture kind of delving into that world. And I always love film for the combination of kind of science and art, truthfully, like in the way, and like when you have these movies that kind of take everything a step forward, like Back to the Future, Jurassic Park, Terminator 2, do you know what I mean? All major steps in achievement of kind of creating that illusion and feeding into an emotional story. I think, you know, it's something that I've always admired and kind of sought after. And I think with Terminator 2, I did a short film. I remember it was like my last, in England, we have like our last bit of comprehensive school, grammar school, age 15, 16. And I remember I was 15, I was revising for exams, and I asked my mother, and my mom, she'll kill me if I called her my mother or anything, my mom to help me. I did this short film which combined animation and live action, and using a Genlock, which is an archaic way of like superimposing Deluxe Paints animation on the top of video that I filmed. And I did basically an homage to Terminator 2 called The Sneeze, which starred me, embarrassingly, and it's like it's on the internet somewhere, so I know it's kind of lookable upable, but it's basically me. I sneeze this disgusting great big sneeze that turns into a little green T-1000 essentially and attacks me and tries to murder me in my own house, and it was a lot of fun, and I got to kind of marry those two ends. And truthfully, like, and that film, what was great is that that's what it went around a bunch of festivals, won a bunch of stuff, got me a job in TV for real, and that's what led to me. But even, you know, to this day, like having a hand in visual effects, especially on a movie like Final Score, is you know, it's so essential, because understanding the way it all works, it's kind of as important as understanding how, you know, how the camera works and how the edit works, all those kind of elements. I think they really, I think the more you can kind of exercise the muscles of each area, the better. Because everyone's doing the same job at the end. Everyone's trying to tell a good story, bring about a great experience. And I think, you know, having a hand in visual effects is, you know, you get to be able to, it affects everything. It's like we're filming us now, and mm-hmm. we would, you know, filming this. And let's say we can't get a wide shot without getting the boom in shot. It's kind of like, oh, well, let's just shoot it with a booming shot, because it's so easy to cut the boom out shot in the Avid, and it's like a no-cost VFX. So let's just do that way and save ourselves an extra setup, right? And mm-hmm. things like that that feed into making a film become very, you know, I found them very good weapons to be armed with, you know.
Especially if you're working, as you're saying, more of low tech, or you have a smaller budget, know when, all right, you know, we don't want to waste time and money on that, when we can just do something super fast and post and knock this out.
100%. And it's always, you know, filmmaking, directing is compromising. Do you know what I mean? It's always down to that. But if you can compromise into a place that gives you a bit of an up, you know, and you can get it into a place that the combination of what kind of one side plus the other is a good marriage, then you can get a lot more bang for your buck, basically.
So this short helps get you into television.
The Sneeze, yeah.
Yes.
It was, it's funny watching it now. And it's embarrassing, because I'm like a 15-year-old boy, kind of, and I'm fighting myself, by the way. Like, the little green man in that was played, like, I acted it out in my garden, filmed from a window, and then kind of rotoscoped round every frame to do it. It was very, like, laborious. You know, clearly I'm a nerd growing up, right? Yeah. It's like, I should have been out playing, or like meeting girls, not kind of drawing around pictures of myself.
Look where it led you.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. Right here to be with me. Well,
exactly, you know, and it's all to the serendipity, right? Yeah,
it's all downhill from here. So you start working in television. What do you start working on?
Well, I started, you know, it was an entertainment. I worked on kind of an entertainment channel, and there was two sides of the channel. One was lifestyle, which is great. I got to learn how to kind of studio direct, which again is a good kind of skill set for mm-hmm. filming stunts and action, especially when you're using multiple cameras. But largely it was kind of, it was like either innocent lifestyle, but the other side I worked on was a channel called Men and Motors. It was Granada Men and Motors, or Granada Breeze. And there was a bunch of us, I think, I want to say 100 of us. We were all kind of young, hungry filmmakers, basically, making the stuff. But Men and Motors was there. The tagline was fast cars and faster women. So it was a very bizarre, place to learn filmmaking, but there was an element, you know, I think across every genre, you know, you learn different things, and there's a huge difference than me working with one camera at home, you know, doing every aspect of the jack of all trades job, to going into a studio, you know, studio environment, TV environment, delivery deadlines, and the kind of disciplines that are involved with that. And I honestly learned, like, so I honestly felt like I learned more in the first 3 weeks of working there than I had all the way up to that point. Do you know what I mean? It really was throwing me in the deep end, and it was a great place to learn those skills.
Especially when you have other people that are working with you and for you.
Yeah.
Learning, do you micromanage? Do you step back and trust the people that are working with you to that you know that they're experts and they'll deliver what you need?
100%. And that's a hard thing to learn for a lot of people, I think. And I'm friends and I work with a bunch of those guys. Still, like right on Final Score, for example, like James Arnold, sound guy, Mark McQueen, second unit director. You know, these are guys that I grew up with there and that I still have worked with now, who are brilliant. Dan De Castro, our Spanish camera op, who's a great guy. You know, he did Heist as well, actually. And so I love working with them because they're friends. They're really talented folks, and we all kind of grew up in the same hustle together. So yeah, I have great memories of that. And I was the young one, man. And that's been that's always been a difficult thing. Being the young, a young director is kind of difficult. It was kind of easier then because we were all young. But then I remember stepping into my first feature. I was I guess I was 26 or 27 directing the tournament on set there. And, you know, when you're up against kind of like the Ving Rhames of this world, it's hard. Our first feature is difficult for a lot of reasons because you're kind of trying to create your position and there's kind of insecurities at play. But then when you're younger, it's kind of like you have that age barrier to get through as well. So but it's grown up, right? And that's learning, I guess.
But do you find, because it's always curious, especially with actors that have been around much longer than a first-time director.
Yeah.
When it comes to that point for working with them and directing them, and how open actors are to this is your first time. Let me show you how it's done.
Yeah, yeah. I would say Ving was like that. Yeah, because I'd Ving and Bobby Carlyle, Kelly Hu. I'd say Bobby and Kelly were great, right? They were totally down with it. But Ving was not so great. and I love Ving's work, and I think he's a great guy. You know, great actor. But yeah, it was difficult. But on reflection and truth, I would handle situations with Ving now very differently than I would handle them 10 years ago, you know? So I think it's a mix of both worlds. But yeah, it's a little bit of a shame when you have actors that don't give that room or kind of help that out. Because really, you kind of need to be empowered by, especially by your actors, you know? You need them to empower you and believe in you and kind of to move things forward. And I think especially for a first time film or first time anything, honestly. I think there's also a starstruck nature, honestly. Like when you're starting out, you're kind of like, holy shit, it's Ving Rhames, you know? It's like, don't tell Ving that. You're like, whoa. You kind of get a bit starstruck. And I think all the way until, to be honest, I broke my starstruck element with De Niro, I think, when I met Bob for the first time. That was like, after that, I don't get starstruck now.
Yeah, I mean, I can understand why not. I mean, and is that the case with him putting you at ease, or just you realizing I've just got to get over that kind of hurdle myself?
Yeah, it was as much get over that hurdle. Like, there's no, you know, you're asking. It's a funny position to be in, because I think what a lot of people don't realize is, especially with A-list talent, you they're as much interviewing you for the job as you for them. It's not. Do you know what I mean? It's like you have to. You know, you take those meetings. And I remember my first thing with Bob was like, I had to get on a Skype call with him. And I remember I kind of was moving around my house in Manchester, like, where do I sit? And I was putting all this pressure on me for this 1 o'clock phone call with Bob De Niro. And thankfully it went very well. But then it went so well. In fact, it was weird. It almost all collapsed. Like, we almost didn't make that film. Like, the first thing on the Skype was like he had issues with the character, which I understood because I read the original draft of it. It'd been through this development kind of loop, and there was issues with the character, and I think we all knew it. And so he was kind of walking away from the film when I first met him. You know, I mean, he was on his way out the door, not in. And I had to kind of pitch. I kind of said, look, I know these are the problems, but I've got this idea that I think it'd be nice for the character that I'm personally connected to, which is like to explore the themes of fatherhood and to say it's this guy is in this place and it's kind of like a test for himself. And actually, my pitch was hopefully better than that. That's so vague. but he liked it enough to kind of say, look, is there any way you can be in New York tomorrow or something? And I was like, yeah, yes. And then like, sure. Yeah, as you do. Yeah. And I remember waiting at the corner just outside. There's a little bagel breakfast, great breakfast place, actually, just opposite Tribeca Films, the entrance there. And I just remember being super, super nervous and jet lagged that I'd flown over, and I had to kind of talk Bob through this. I had to meet him for starts and then talk him through this, you know, the, like where I wanted to take the story, wanted to do the script. And but as soon as I hugged him, he was so like soft and cuddly. It was like, and he was such a nice guy that it was very relaxing, and he was such a sweet guy, and he like invited me into his like office. We just worked on the script and talked about filmmaking for the, you know, for hours. And ever since then, I realized that, you know, it's a two-way relationship, right? You've got to be kind of you've got to be very respectful, but also they're looking for leadership. And that was something that Bob really kind of instills. He really trusts his director, and it's like, and but he wants to check that he can trust his director, mm-hmm. I guess. And I think he it was wonderful to have that trust and to kind of go through it. It's definitely one of my treasured experiences, I would say, making that film and going through that experience with him, because, you know, he's all-time great, and it was great to do.
Well, I figure, like, going forward, I mean, that eliminates, Bob De Niro vouch for me. Come on now.
It's more, you know, it's more just comfort with, I think, I feel like you kind of align into what an actor needs, you know? Like, an actor needs directing, and I think, or actors, like, you know, they want direction. Like, just like the camera guys want direction. Everyone wants direction, do you know what I mean? Because no one can really judge if that's the right job or the wrong job, because it's a matter of opinion, and essentially you're like guiding them with your opinion, and that's really what I learned from Bob. Is he really wanted me to guide him, and that made me realize, hold on, I shouldn't step back from people by being polite or afraid of their opinion, you know what I mean? Because you, as a director, you really try and, you know, guide your own, and it's a two-way street, right? Because you're working with very talented folks, and you're collaborating to a large extent anyway. But yeah, you've got to kind of be truthful about what you think is right, and try and kind of, you know, try and kind of push that forward as best you can.
Well, as warm and as inviting as he was during the meeting, and you're working things out.
Yeah.
What is it like on set the first time that you're like, I got to give Robert De Niro.
You know, that's a really good question, because I remember that moment exactly. And even like one of the writers, Max, he's next to me. And I'm like, Max, do I go and tell him to do, try it like this? And it was like, I think you should. Because, yeah, I remember thinking, right, he did a take. It was a scene where he's in bed with this girl. And he gets a phone call to tell about the bad news, about the money being stolen or something. And he did it, and it was fine, but it was like, it wasn't quite how I'd pictured it when we worked on the script, and it wasn't exactly, you know, it wasn't the way. And so, yeah, I was really nervous going to say to him, hey, Bob, do you think we could do one, you know, with a bit more, where you're a bit more ticked off about it? It was a very simple kind of throw-in note. And he was like, absolutely, I'd love to. And he was like, and the fact he took it on board, and then it got to a point where I would keep rolling. And it's a trick, actually, I think that, for better or for worse, when you've got these kind of squeezed budgets and you're doing this like lo-fi, you know, when you're doing this low budget, big movie type stuff, is to keep rolling, right? For the actor's sake, for the energy of the crew, and also for a time point of view, that you don't have time to do like a 20-minute reset over everything. But I think it's good to keep momentum and energy up. So what I would do, and a trick that I kind of learned there, was keep rolling. And literally, I could step at the edge of frame, and then I can go in and say give him a note, and give the actors notes at the time, and just have the, you know, and just kind of repeat through it. And I think it's a really good way of, as long as you can kind of keep track of where you are from a material point of view and an editing mm-hmm. point of view, have a good script suit for sure. You can get, that's where I found kind of the best performances to come from. You know, you work it up and you bring the energy and you get the energy to be a place. And actors need different things, you know, like, I remember one funny thing, really, because Jeff D. Morgan and Maurice Chestnut, both, you know, lovely, great actors and like lovely people. And we were all, you know, we have this scene in Bus 657. Well, it was originally Bus 657, it got renamed Heist. But we had this scene on a bus where I remember like Maurice is beating up Jeff and like he's kind of tied to a post and he's getting beaten up. And we're doing it on camera with the cameras at them first, and we film all this stuff, and Jeff's really getting, they're both kind of getting into it, maybe a bit too much, and Maurice is like, and Jeff is like, oh, and he's like, man, Maurice, can you kind of go a bit easy on me? And then And we're thinking, all right, but we got it on camera. It was, you know, it was good. Everyone was for it. And then we turn around to look on Bob and film his side of it. And Jeff's like, Scott, do you mind if we don't, like, pour the water, which is supposed to be petrol, and, like, beat me up so much? Like, how much do we see? And I was like, we don't really see anything. Like, we see a little glimmer. And I say, I'm all right. Dan, I'm on B camera. Can you see anything? He's like, no, I'm good. I said, you're all good. It's all right. Just kind of mime through it. You know, don't worry about it. And then Bob was like, actually, would you mind doing it for me? And obviously when he says that, everyone's like, not at all.
Sure.
Yeah, sure, we'll get beaten up. And then poor GDM just gets beaten up by Morris for another six takes. So, yeah, it's funny to look back. But yeah, people need different ingredients, you know, but usually the input kind of equals the output. So.
Well, I can see why you're saying when you've worked with so many of the people that you were mentioning, that, you know, since the early days, yeah. Back with Men and Motors.
Yes. Yeah, Men and Motors, yeah, yes. Yeah, with Joe Guest and Jordan.
But I guess it's that, and I guess like every filmmaking crew, you look for that team that you understand each other's rhythms, and especially if you're working in more of a lo-fi thing, you've got a team that is used to that knows it and knows what's needed and expected of them.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, the truth is you can never underestimate the value of just a great, you know, cast. They say like casting is a huge part of obviously a film. Do you know, I think Spielberg says like 90% of the work is done in casting, which I think is true, but also with the crew. Do you know, I mean, you cast your crew, you get the right crew, like you try and get the right ingredients of a family to merge together and give you kind of what you need for a particular job, you know, and that's a huge part of it, which it's kind of a behind the scenes anxiety that we don't see or talk about a lot, but it's definitely, you know, in those last weeks leading up to the film, it's hard, you know.
Well, I mean, I guess like with any family unit, you hopefully try to keep the core intact, but
yeah, yeah.
Other opportunities arise and people will take other things that schedules conflict and they can't make it.
Yep.
How easy is it to integrate somebody new into the mix when the majority of people are like, we've already know the routines?
Well, truth be told, I think I've ended up kind of usually having a mix of, but I've never had like the opportunity to keep a family unit. It's very often the case of like where it's shooting, right? So depending, like the shoots tend to take place where the tax credit is greatest and that varies depending on the movie. So it kind of moves around and then there's a requirement to hire locally, right? And there's different times when you're allowed to kind of bring people over and you can't, and there's a certain kind of like mix. So my crews tend to have been, you know, a mix of kind of old and new, but you meet new people that way. But yeah, it is difficult to, it's always difficult to kind of get to speed. It's weird with it. What I love about filmmaking is like, you do go on this kind of circus adventure with people that you bond with like a family, and you are very, you're so close to. So by the end of a shoot, you know, like the final score shoot in particular, like because we shot at a stadium, a real stadium, we ended up, you know, we're in London, but there was no point like traveling home every night. You know, there's no point spending an hour in London traffic and an hour and a half back again or whatever to, you know, in the limited hours you've got between the shoot to go anywhere. So we converted the boxes of the stadium to rooms, and we stayed in the stadium. So we lived there for the best part of like 2 months and at least 2 months, in fact, like probably 10 weeks in total. And we ended up, you know, and that it was kind of like a university dormitory, you know, like we're all together, like we're all racing around playing football, like in the corridors, I remember, just, you know, of this busy abandoned stadium. And it's a unique thing where you bond closely with crew and you try and work with people, you know, you can't work with everyone every time. That's a hard thing. Like, I think it's a shame that you can't, and everyone understands that happens. But yeah, I've been lucky with a lot of great crew in my time, to be honest.
Well, you also direct television as well.
Yeah.
And I feel like the difference for that is that crew is pretty much established and you're the one that's kind of dropping in and joining them for that particular episode.
That's totally true. And it's, you know, and it's a different, you know, I've really enjoyed TV directing, actually. I find, especially between films and between writing, it's very, because you are kind of a cog in a machine and someone else is really the head of, you know, the showrunner is the head of that that family. And you've got to kind of go with, you've got to kind of integrate into that family, and it's and what's nice about it, it's navigating something slightly different. Like you've usually got an aesthetic that you're kind of a sandbox to play in, you know, and it I found it really stretches you
as a filmmaker to try, you know, to play in a different area, somewhere you're uncomfortable with even. You wouldn't have gone there. Like, I just did a show in Puerto Rico, and the guy who did the pilot, Jeff Thomas, great director, did this. The style of the show was very unique, and I hadn't kind of gone there before, and it's a lot of fun to try that, you know, different method, and it's different kind of filmmaking, you know. And there's also a great thing of there's a pressure thing of you're in it temporarily. There's not the same kind of pressure as a film where every decision from kind of start to end is yours and kind of on your neck. And even the decisions that you don't have final say over, they're on your neck anyway, you know? So if you end up with a different piece of music in a film, you probably don't want it, and you know you'll get criticized for it, but it wasn't even your choice. But yeah, there's an element of freedom in the slight less pressure to kind of, you know, you've got to please the showrunner. It's there, you know, that's what you're trying to do justice to and really kind of, you know, excel what, break their expectations, hopefully, and kind of do a great job for them. And it is a different discipline, but I've honestly enjoyed it. I find it very refreshing coming off a film to go into TV. It kind of balances me again, you know?
Well, the one thing I was always curious about in terms of directing television is it seems that you could conceivably know your kind of life schedule for several years out, because I remember talking to a director that was doing Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Yeah.
He says, oh yeah, I'm coming. They already booked me for next season finale.
Yeah.
I'm like, holy cow, you already know like a little bit more than a year where you're going to be at and doing.
Yeah. I think that, it's much more of a kind of business, I guess, than like films. All the films I've been involved with, they've always had this random scheduling. They've also like fallen apart. Like I also produced and a number of times. Do you know what I mean? I've seen films almost happen. Everyone gears their life up and then it falls apart. You know, it's a common, unfortunately, a common thing. And I think, you know, it's a lot more reliable television because it's, you know, if a television show is happening, it's happening. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's getting delivered. It's going ahead. And that's also kind of an attraction, I guess, for, you know, especially like myself. I got a family, you know, it's like balancing time and life and the kind of, you know, that's the hardest thing I think that I found, at least, to kind of balance out is like, especially when you're doing a job you really love, you know, and you've got a family you really love. It's like it's managing the balance of time and you know, making sure you're there for your kids growing up, really. So TV is, it's good for that, for sure.
For sure. I feel like anything that can give somebody that is working in a predominantly freelance kind of environment some points of kind of security.
Yeah.
Like, all right, I know my schedule for a year. I can plan things because I know where I have to be a year from now.
Yeah. Although that said, it's the old joke, right? My wife, bless her, like, she knows never to book a holiday. Or if you want to guarantee that I'm going to get a gig at a certain time, book a holiday for that time and I guarantee a gig will come up the week before.
That is true. And you can't, how can so you say slow. No?
Yeah. Well, yeah. It seems to happen a lot.
Well, let's dive into Final Score.
Yes, sure. Absolutely.
Because you talked a little bit about the stadium.
Yeah.
And what I thought was, because this whole thing birthed from the fact that this stadium was set to be demolished to be turned into an apartment building.
Yeah, that's 100% right. Yeah, it's the weirdest thing. Like this a couple of them were involved with producers on Heist, and so I'd known them from that. And they introduced me to the third producer, Mark Goldberg, and he was a lifelong West Ham fan, and he'd heard about the stadium being closed down, and because it was getting demolished, it had this period where no one could touch it. I think to do with English heritage, searching the site for remains, and, you know, things like historical elements. It was relatively kind of abandoned, left free for a period of like 8 weeks or something. And he was the one with the idea, maybe we could make a movie. And so they got together in such a quick time where I think I met them in February, I believe. And they just got the first draft of a script that they'd commissioned people to come up with ideas for only like 2 months before or something. So you know, like most movies take 7 years, right, to make. This one, they'd kind of managed to get a script together in record time. And when I read it, the brothers Lynch wrote this draft. It was so much better than it should have ever been. And I think it was probably freeing the fact that they didn't have time to kind of procrastinate too much about it. It was very fresh and original and it had all these kind of surprisingly, you know, these risky moments and things that you wouldn't normally see in a film like this. And And I remember from that point, it was like, right, if we want to do this, we've got to get it cast and we've got to shoot the film before this day in like July, August, I think it was, when the stadium is getting demolished. So it was literally like this gun to the head of like, we were all like, honestly, like from the start, we were very much in the mindset, all of us involved were like, we're going to roll the dice on this. It probably won't happen because this looks like an impossible mountain to climb. And it did. And that's the miracle of it. Like, and that's the pushing. You know, there was a lot of behind the scenes, intense kind of stresses to do that, to squeeze it through that gap. And for me, yeah, it started with that script. And then we did a polish on that script before we sent it out to talent. And then talent started attaching. And it was just this crazy, crazy roller coaster.
Because what I thought was so interesting is as they have the empty stadium, mm-hmm. they don't have anything, no idea, no director, no nothing. Actors, no script, no nothing.
Yep.
How often have you, because I mean, there's many stories about how many different productions come to life.
Yeah.
But it just seems more rare that you have like, oh, we have this location for this maximum amount of time. Let's create a film.
Yeah, what a reason to make a movie, right?
Yeah.
it's low down on the biggest reasons to go ahead and make a film. But yeah, no, I think the way that works is you have an opportunity. I think films generally have this thing, have the nature of they're a risk, right? People are spending millions of dollars on, you know, on something that, on fairy dust that doesn't even exist, on nothing. Do you know what I mean? In the hope that people want to see that. And it's like, and it almost always, in my experience, needs an odd reason to be happening. You know what I mean? Whether it's a director's, an actor's schedule, you know, they've got, mm-hmm. like, that's a very common one, right? Like, the actor wants to do the project, but they can only do it in this date for time frame, you know? Or, you know, the money, you've got a tax credit, like, and the tax credit is going to run out and not be there from, like, December, so you've got to get it together. And very often than not, I think when people have something to lose, it creates a different mindset from imagining something to win. And I think that's what happened with the stadium. It's like we had an opportunity, you had something to lose, and then every step it kind of piled on something else to lose. Do you know what I mean? Like something attached, like Pierce attached, it becomes kind of greenlit to a degree. You've got that to, you know, you've got Pierce Brosnan and a stadium you're going to demolish on camera. They're two elements that you've got to lose, right? It's weird, but in a way, not surprising. It's definitely like, not, you know, when you think of, like, I can't sit here and say, I really wanted to make a movie.
That was that's right. Yeah.
You know, but the advantage, honestly, is you can, you know, that's the canvas and you can paint what you want in there. So for me, the attraction on this one was not only the material, but I really wanted to do like a big action film that was British, that was filmed in Britain, had a British sensibility, had, you know, these unique elements to it that you don't often see in a movie of this size. And I'd been wanting to do that for a long time. And I tried to do that to a degree with my first film, The Tournament. And I guess did in one sense, but it was, you know, we shot a lot of that in Europe. It wasn't so kind of British as this. And I loved the absurdity of it all, of all these ingredients and the situation. And kind of we all ran with that, really.
Well, I'm curious about, in terms for you, the British sensibility that you want to bring to a film that's kind of a nice homage or to like the late 80s, early 90s kind of action films. Yeah. What is the British sensibility to that?
I'd say like British humor. Do you know what I mean? Like there's a certain, I don't know, that like the sarcasm tends to kind of travel differently in different countries. And I don't know, you know, it's very tongue in cheek. And I think I think there's just many elements that kind of characters will make choices with where, yeah, it's nice to look at the kind of fish out of water, the differences between, you know, Britain and America. And I know them well as a person kind of having recently moved to America. I love the States and I've kind of been on both sides now. But it's interesting looking at the differences that we all have, you know, from as simple as you guys call it soccer, you know, and you call something else football where you don't even use your feet pretty much. It's like, so there's lots of that kind of thing. But yeah, the I don't know, I think the British element, I would say, is the surprises, is where it kind of gets a bit daring, where it doesn't kind of just go broad mainstream. And I think, you know, we naturally write and work in a place where there's a kind of an easier path that's a well-trodden path that certain scenes, moments, and sequences can go, and it's kind of bending away from that, saying what's the fresh version of that, and what's, you know, being inventive with set pieces and things. And you know, a thing for me in that script that I that kind of screamed out to me. And in a way, one of the reasons I remember that switched me from not sure to I actually want to do this was when they have a scene where they kind of hold the presenters hostage, right? Read a statement. And then the fact he not only shot the presenter, but he shoots Tony Cotti. The guys in the studio too. I was like, that's it. Like, I loved how shocking that was. You know, it kind of tickled my kind of RoboCop humor of it all. And I loved it. And moments like that really shine, I think.
That was an unexpected moment for me. I was, because you think you've seen enough of these films, like, we're just going to cut right after they read the speech,
it. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. We're not going to see that. And I had a fight with that, honestly. Like, that, and again, like, my producers, they were great. Like, it was like they really, you know, they really kind of support the film and looked at the long game on the film. They were brilliant. But it wasn't without conflict during the movie, right, as a director and the producers. And I remember we got to a spot where we had a really major opportunity to tie in, like, the biggest sports network to do that scene, right? We were originally doing it as a kind of generic, our own made-up one, so it didn't tie in the brand. But we had this opportunity that came up literally days before we had to shoot it, where we were offered this really dangly carrot of, this is a huge brand we could tie into, and it became this business thing. But the caveat is, you can't shoot them. You can only have them read it. And I just remember, like, I got into this huge battle just saying, no, we are not, like, that is going over the edge. Do you know what I mean? We're going over the edge, and we're in that territory then of broad scale film. Do you know what I mean? If you can't, it's like, I really, really wanted to, like, shoot Tony Cotti on the screen. And it's like, we've got to do that. So I remember there was a battle, and I remember even the people involved were very glad that kind of I won that battle, because now, you know, it's worth it in the film. So I think it's all good. And you know, and it turned out that brand ended up supporting the film and being a big part of the film anyway. So it wasn't, you know, it turned out well. But
and what announcer is not going to enjoy, like, their own death scene?
Yeah, you know, exactly.
Come on, yeah.
Like, at West Ham, you know what I mean? It's like, of all places, like, it's a great place. But, you know, it's so meta. It's great.
Well, speaking of, because you're shooting at a stadium, and I'm always interested with films that have a sports element to it, especially when you use that as a ticking clock.
Yeah.
How much of what you're shooting on the field is that you shoot there on location, or are you just shooting another game and actually cutting it in to make it seem like it was at that stadium?
Man, that side of it was such a fucking nightmare. Was it? It was like the two really difficult elements. Like, you know, like any film, there's a lot of difficult elements. Two of the big kind of difficult elements. One was the football itself. Like, football on film tends to look rubbish, right? Like, it's very difficult to make football look good, because the truth is, these professional players, they're incredible. Do you know what I mean? They're so fast, they're so skilled. It's a completely, do you know what I mean? It's very hard to fake that, right? So that was a struggle, and I kind of looked back at all the different, like, references of who'd done it well, badly, and the rest of it. And also tying into that, the crowd were a problem, because, you know, we're a low budget film. Like, it's like, and all these films that are like this, what you end up doing is you end up ratcheting a film where you essentially have a ratio where on the film itself, you're spending kind of a very limited amount of money. Do you know what I mean? So typically you'll have like an 80% split where you're paying for a great cast, and that's kind of 80% of the budget's been chewed up. 20% is on the film, and you've got to kind of marry those two things, because let's face it, you don't want to film without the cast, and you know what I mean? So you've got to try and find that balance. But where that puts you is in a kind of low budget category of filmmaking. And one of the things you really, it's difficult to cheat, is extras, right? And that's where, like, the lower the budget, the more that gets squeezed. And as filmmakers, it's kind of it's like an old joke, right? It's like you ask for 100 extras and you get 3 or something, you know? And it's, 'cause it's expensive, because as much as, you know, or supporting artists, I don't know if we're allowed to call it, there's a whole kind of terminology thing where in certain countries you can talk to the to extras. I don't know if I'm allowed to call them extras.
I think we call them extras here.
We're okay, yeah. But I can't talk to, under DGA rules, I'm not allowed to talk directly to them, or they become a supporting artist or something.
Oh, interesting.
Something complex. But the bottom line is, it's, I don't know how much it is, but let's just say it's $100 a day. Obviously, 100 of those people, you know, is costing 10 grand. And bear in mind, the stadium fills 35,000. So kind of the scale of, if you were to kind of fill that stadium, what's that, 100 times?
It's 350,000.
100, right? So it's 3.5 million.
Oh, good.
So it's 3.5 million £1,000 a day should you really fill that stadium with people. So getting over that hurdle was a big one, and it's one that you don't want to feel visible. You don't want to feel like it's fake, and you don't want to feel, you know, that's an illusion or CG or anything. So that was a huge thing to solve, a huge problem to solve. And, you know, the simpler way is just to not go near the crowd. It's avoid the crowd altogether. Don't have a scene in the crowd, in the base, and don't go there, right? But then what's the fucking point of making a movie in a stadium? So the way we went about it is we had a few different methods. Again, it was very last minute. So this is like, these methods were kind of with a gun against your head, but I think it was the last game we shot. We went to the last game of West Ham because we kind of, at that point, it was like, right, is everyone willing to gamble a further, I don't know, 10 grand to get like 6-8K cameras there and shoot the audience? And that's what we did. We went to this game and, you know, we had notices as everyone came in and said, look, we're shooting. And it's permissible to use it in the movie, won't be identifiable, all that kind of stuff. And so essentially the audience of that game end up being kind of our background plates. And the way I had to kind of do it is think, all right, where am I probably going to shoot this scene from? So I knew I was shooting a scene in the control room. So I knew we had to have angles from there. I knew I was trying to do this thing at the bottom of the, you know, down by the pitch there. So I thought, right, angles here. And we shot all these different angles, like, hold for 20 seconds, move it, hold for 20 seconds. And it's kind of, you know, you're shooting all these plate shots that you're expecting you're going to put in at another time, you know, in the future. And to be honest, we were writing the film at that point. So it wasn't like we even had a locked script to, you know, normally you'd lock this down with previs and it would all be, you know, it would be a scientific kind of precision. Mm-hmm. But ours was very kind of like ish, you know.
Yeah.
And so we did that. And then we had to, so that kind of fed into the movie. And then we had to just kind of do the thing of, all right, we got 40 extras, you know, who are West Ham fans who are coming here for nothing, you know, for a cup of tea and a sandwich, basically. And those guys who really helped us out, they were our kind of our crowd that we kind of tried to fill out the closer shots with. And then Outpost, the VFX house, they while the stadium was still erected, they scanned a LiDAR scan of the stadium. They did like sprite work, you know, with crowds and things, and they did a lot of great work on the wider shots of the film. And I watched it recently, having a bit of distance, and truth be told, like it looks fun. You don't even think about it, right?
No, I was not thinking about that.
You know, it was always empty when we did it. It was, you know, and it drives performance. That's the other thing, actually. I should say, sound wise, like a sound in a stadium, it's so loud. You've got to raise your voice. You've got to like talk like, hey, we've got to shout like this, you know, and that affects performance. And what I found very quickly was like the way we did it is we played this audience, had Rob turn up the sound basically and had these speakers. And the first take of most setups, especially with like Dave and Amit Shah plays Faisal, first takes usually had the sound cranked right up, so the sound was going to be useless, but we got to a measure of the performance and how they would really say it. Mm-hmm. And then we'd drop it, then we'd play it all the way to the take and then drop it just before they start talking. And it's weird, like when you look at the rushes, you've got Dave in the stands and everything's silent and he's like, go on, shoot! Oh, he's talking to the person and say, what's wrong, Daddy? And he's like talking really loudly and it looks bizarre when you don't know the crowd there, you know, but that's part of the illusion. You pray that it all stitches together, you know.
And that's when, you know, you're going to trust a great director because they're like, all right, I'm Dave Bautista saying I'm going to put myself in your hands, Scott, and I know you're going to take care of it.
Yeah, he's probably like, more or less trusting you. Like, I hope this fucking works, Scott. It's like, but it's hard. I remember I actually cut a little sequence just to show people, like, look, trust us, this works. And we put the audience upon it. We, you know, we did a little pre-cut just to kind of make everyone comfortable because it's very uncomfortable, honestly. It's. I remember Pierce was very much like, Pierce, you know, always wanted to do his takes with the crowd playing full speak because it is a very different experience.
Yeah.
We were very conscious of that.
Well, as we're wrapping up, one last question I want to ask you. Dave Bautista, you worked with him on Heist, but now you have a chance with him to be a good guy. That's something he wanted to play the villain on this.
Yeah.
How fun was it for you to see Dave be able to show off this other aspect of himself?
It was great. And I think I always, like, that's what I learned with Heist, honestly. It's like you've got this really sweet guy, and he's just, there's a part of Dave that I think we hadn't seen before. And that's what was exciting about kind of making this character Dave. And it was very like collaborative in terms of him in terms of the writing process, just because of the nature of the deadline, we were rewriting it essentially for, because originally it wasn't an American character. Originally, in the first script, it was a British guy. And it was, and it really was kind of in that few weeks process of like, actually, it's much more exciting if it's an American guy and we do the fish out of water thing and we put that spin on it. And so that was happening kind of on set in a way. And it was very, it was, you know, every day I would say, I don't know a day when we kind of went there and filmed what was on the script, you know, it always altered to a degree. But yeah, I love that people hadn't seen that side of Dave. I think that there's a lot of the sides of the character that are real Dave, you know, because he is a warm and loving guy. And I think he kind of put that into his relationship on screen there, and it really comes across. And yeah, love him for it. It's
great. What I did like, though, was the him at the beginning getting in from the airport.
Yeah.
Just, you know, telling the guy, the taxi driver, yeah, turn, please, could yeah. you not? I don't want to listen to this.
Sucker, yeah.
So then showing up at the house and he's got two tickets.
Yeah,
he's
yeah.
like, or that should, he's going to swallow it
yeah.
because he wants to do right by his best friend's daughter.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, it's sweet.
So, Scott, I could talk to you for hours.
I know, I couldn't even force it. Sorry.
No worries. But if they want to keep tracking everything that you're working on, yep. what do you have coming up next?
I've got another film that Mir will see. It's kind of, might shoot the end of this year, but it's all kind of like in the, you know, in the contract side, which is a very exciting action film, which is very, very good script. But we'll see, again, we'll see with how these things kind of pan out. And a couple of TV projects that I've just come back from one, and I'm looking at going back and doing another bit of television to extend my directing muscles in different aesthetics.
Fantastic. And I know that you're constantly on social media. We have to stop you from getting on that social media.
Of course you do, yes. One every 4 years is what I am for.
But if they want to keep up to date with what you're doing, what's for your occasional tweet?
For my occasional tweet, I think it's ScottyMan79. And I just signed up to Instagram for the first time. I think I'm ScottMan. I want to say I'm ScottMan. Is it great? ScottyMan on Twitter. Yes, okay. ScottyMan on Twitter. And maybe the same on Instagram. It's new waters for me. But I enjoy it. It's quite addictive, really, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah. Worryingly.
Now you're going to be spent. How many likes?
Yeah, how many likes? I've seen that episode of Black Mirror.
Oh, no, I haven't seen that yet.
Oh, that's so good. And that's why I stayed away from it. I watched that. I was like, I don't want to end up like that.
Ladies and gentlemen, my guest today has been Scott Mann. Make sure you check out Final Score, again, coming out in theaters September 14th, as well as video on demand and digital HD. It's a fun romp. If you love Die Hard, you love those late 80s, early 90s action movies, this is a movie that just embraces all those great aesthetics and has a lot of fun doing it.
Thank you.
All right, folks, feel free to follow me. Again, I'm Frank Moran on Twitter and Instagram. I'll try to do more than what Scott does, the occasional, you know, once every 4 year tweet. At Happy Go Jackie. Ladies and gentlemen, thanks for joining us here for iTalk Movies. We'll be back with another episode right here on Popcorn Talk.
Brilliant. Thank you, buddy.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, we would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network. The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Popcorn Talk Network or its owners or principals.